In our desire to better understand the Ukraine, I want to share some insights from an editorial. It was written by Jill Dougherty. She is CNN's Moscow bureau chief. She was a correspondent for CNN from 1997 through 2005. She also served as the White House correspondent for CNN and recently CNN's foreign affairs correspondent covering the State Department. Now, she is a fellow at Harvard University. Politics and public policy is her purview. She is particularly astute in issues related to Russia. With that introduction, she wrote, "As Washington pundits watch the carnage in Kiev, images of a Russian President Vladimir Putin as a puppet master of the Ukraine is being presented, with Viktor Yanukovych as his puppet. Putin, the theory goes, is willing to stroke a civil war in order to keep the Ukraine from turning to the West. Now, America's obsession," she wrote, "with Putin does not explain the complex realities fueling, fueling the uprising in Ukraine or the uneasy relationship between Putin and Yanukovych. Long before the uprising began, if Yanukovych had carried out real economic and political reform, by doing that, what he would have to have done is to radically diminish the size of the Ukrainian government. It's the only thing that would postpone the inevitable in America. You know, America's going to crash economically. And the only thing that would postpone that reality is diminishing the size of every aspect of the U.S. government by 20% a year for the next 5 years until it's just a fraction of its current size. If Yanukovych had tried to do that, he'd probably have been killed a long time ago, but that's what needed to be done. And economic reform was necessary, too, to release the potential of people to drive the economy through free enterprise as opposed to regulate every aspect and tax every aspect of the economy. But he has been caught between a long-term promise of a closer relationship with Europe, which is tied to IMF loans, which would radically change the size of the Ukrainian government and therefore handouts, and an immediate gift of money from Moscow, with the Kremlin's demand that only they toughen up and put down opposition demonstrations. But Yanukovych, up for re-election in 2015, was not willing to bite either bullet. He was not willing to accept the terms of the West or of Russia. This expert says Yanukovych tried to play both sides against the middle. Quote, "Yanukovych has played Putin against Europe and the United States quite masterfully." At least he did until now he's being hunted as a murderer. "So there is no love lost between them and no trust there. That is a myth, then, that has been promoted by American propaganda, that somehow Yanukovych and Putin are comrades in arms and that they are tied together. Actually, Putin's no fan of Yanukovych." And this now is not only by the author of this, but also by Eugene Rumer, who until this month served as U.S. National Intelligence Officer for Russia and for Eurasia at the CIA. So even the CIA knows that what the National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, is saying about the Ukraine is untrue. The quality of the discussion here in Washington has really become appalling. Eugene Rumer, the CIA bureau chief and intelligence chief for Russia and Eurasia, said, "It has become appalling. A lot more has been said about Russia and Russia's role, but it ignores the fact that Ukraine has been an independent state for the last 25 years, and that this crisis is really a domestic political crisis in the Ukraine. It's actually an economic crisis in the Ukraine, and not having the political will to do what's right. We don't in America either. Not that the Russians haven't helped, but the Ukrainian domestic upheaval is a domestic political crisis based upon the bad judgments, the bad choices the Ukrainians have made. Putin does have interest in Ukraine, a desire to keep NATO and its U.S. military bases out, ties with Ukrainian aircraft and shipping enterprises closely linked with the Russia's military's industrial complex, and his own Black Sea Fleet in Ukraine's port of Sevastopol on the Crimean Peninsula, as well as enduring unimpeded transit of natural gas to Europe. Yeah, those are his vested interests. Doesn't want American military or European military bases in the Ukraine. Not reasonable. It's in his sphere of influence. Doesn't want to have the transit of natural gas pipelines to Europe impeded as they go through the western Ukraine. And this says his Black Sea Fleet, but I'm telling you, there is no risk to his Black Sea Fleet. Not only has there been an extension way beyond the time that the Earth as we know it's going to exist, the Crimean Peninsula is Russian. Yanukovych, however, has never been Russia's man, says Dmitry Tenin, director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. I think that's a complete myth, he writes. He's been very difficult to partner with Russia. A very unreliable partner, someone who has let the Russians down on many occasions, just as he has the West, you know, promising to terms for massive IMF loans. And then within a year of that time, the IMF saying, but you've welched on every part of the agreement. The Ukrainians, and Yanukovych particularly, is someone not to be trusted. He's not trusted by the Russians. He's not trusted by the International Monetary Fund. He's not trusted by the Europeans. He, like the people he's representing, are not trustworthy. Yanukovych's only goal is to stay in power and to protect his wealth and the wealth of his family, says Trenin. With Yanukovych vacillating between Russia and Europe and always having his own private interests in mind, it's mind-boggling. So the Russians have long given up on Yanukovych. Yet this is always presented as, oh boy, the European democracy loving Ukrainians have taken out the Russian puppet of the great puppet master Putin, and now the Russians are really mad. No, it's not the case. It's all a pile of lies. But it's easy to rally a country to war, to rally a country to do something stupid when you demonize certain individuals. Putin's envoy to Kiev refused to sign the latest truce between Yanukovych and the opposition, in which they agreed on earlier elections in return to a constitution that would shift more power from the president to parliament. I think the Kremlin feels cold-shouldered. Kremlin says, I think he feels betrayed by Yanukovych. Betrayed may be too strong a word, but certainly Yanukovych has managed to play the Europeans off of the Russians. Russia would fight to protect the ethnic Russian population and Moscow's base in Crimea, says Harvard's Sandinista, quoting a senior Russian government official who told the Financial Times, quote, if Ukraine breaks apart, it will trigger a war. They will lose Crimea first because we will go in and protect it, as we did in Georgia. Those are the forces that we're playing with. I have another related story. This one much closer to home. It is in San Jose, California. The story reads as follows. You'll see the connection here in a moment. Here in the wealthiest heart of the Silicon Valley, the roads are pocketed with potholes. The libraries are closed 3 days a week. And a slew of city recreation centers have been handed over to nonprofit groups. Taxes have gone up, even as city services are in rapid decline. The source of Chuck Reed's concern, who is the mayor, is that gold-plated pensions that guaranteed retired city workers as much as 90% of their former salaries for not working are way too costly. Retirement costs are eating up a quarter of the city's budget, forcing the community to cut back everything else. You see, public pensions may be the single most debilitating aspect of American politic and economics. It is the thing that has brought down the Ukraine, brought the country to its knees. It is the thing that is looming as the final nail in America's coffin. This is a quote. "This is one of the dichotomies of California," this mayor said. "I'm cutting services to my low and moderate income people to pay really generous benefits for public employees who made a very good living and have an even better retirement," he said in an interview. In San Jose and across the nation, state and local officials are increasingly confronting a vision of startling injustice. Poor and middle-class taxpayers who often have no retirement savings are paying higher taxes so public employees can retire in lavish comfort. This is a program that we devoted an hour to, a subject we devoted an hour to on this program about 6 to 9 months ago, where I said, what happened in American politics is because we don't have those who understand business in politics. They mortgaged our future. Politicians, and particularly in California, but California was followed across the country and nationally, realized, and this is what also happens with the auto unions and many other unions, that if they negotiated huge pensions and huge retirement benefits to the unions, that they could gradually increase their regular pay to a level that's already grossly in excess of what the same job would be in the private sector, but could postpone accountability of their appeasement of unions by putting in law huge pensions for them down the road, which would burden future generations of politicians, bankrupt the future while making the politician more electable and more likable in the present. This is what they did. By doing this, they lit a fuse that is going to destroy this country. There is no resolution here, because not only is the problem not resolvable because no one's going to be willing to give up their pensions, it's actually getting worse. Returning to the time bomb, the ticking time bomb that is certain to destroy California and the rest of the nation. There is now an act called the California Secure Choice Retirement Savings Trust Act. And what it essentially does is it takes the 3.5 million public workers in California, and it says that their pension plan, you know, they're not, as a public workers, they're not subjected to Social Security, which is a pyramid scheme, that the state of California is going to assure a minimum return on the investments in that plan. The state, which can't manage anything, is going to manage the plans financially and then guarantee a return on them. And so rather than going in the right direction, which is to realize that what was offered to these public employees, both in salary and in benefits and in retirement, was egregious, and that they ought not have been given any of these things, and there should be no public unions, we instead are exacerbating the problem. And folks, it is the very thing that is going to destroy us. Now, I want to make the transition to the Seventh-day Adventists in the remaining time of this hour. We had promised that we would get through issues that edicts that they have raised. Yesterday we were talking about their 19th edict, which was the law of God. Now, it just shows how just stunningly ignorant and irrational the religious have to be. Now, first of all, from an ignorant point of view, the Torah is never referred to as law. You can study the etymology of Torah all day long. You can study how Yahweh introduces the concept of Torah. You can say, you can study the context in which Yahweh discusses his Torah. And when you do that, what you find is that there is no reference to law or to the concept of obeying laws anywhere. That the etymology of Torah, etymology means the word study of Torah, is teaching. Teaching, guidance, direction, instruction. The difference between an instruction and a law is night and day. The difference between guidance and an edict, night and day. The difference between the actual Hebrew word that is corrupted to obey, which is shama, which means to listen, and obedience, is night and day. These things are such an egregious alteration of what God had to say that it demonstrates that the scholars of the Christian religion are either completely ignorant or they're completely dishonest. Now, on the irrational side of religion, if God did have law, if God has a document, even if it's not law, that is based upon his guidance, his teaching, if it's foundational to his relationship with his people, that document is called the Torah. Yahusha spoke of it often. The Torah. Now, if the Torah is from God, which they're admitting here, then their religion is rubbish. Because the basis of Christianity is Paul's letters. And Paul attacks the Torah. I mean, the Christians believe that the Torah has been done away with, that it's been annulled, that it was mean that it was impotent, that it could not save anyone, that it all it did was blame people, and it was impossible. And therefore, that God decided that he would throw away his Torah and come up with an entirely different plan. And after having Yahusha affirm every aspect of his Torah, would have this mass murderer, this man who admitted that he was demon-possessed and insane, contradict everything God had said, demean everything God had said, and come up with an entirely different plan. So if God authorized, if God inspired his Torah, since every aspect of Christianity contradicts it, demeans it, annuls it, there is a 0% possibility that Christianity can be reliable. And so by even having an edict which addresses it, as this does, although it uses the wrong term, law of God, then what they are doing, if they were rational, is they're destroying their religion. This reads, the great principles of God's law are embodied in the Ten Commandments and are explained in the life of Christ, while Yah's teaching is embodied in his Ten Statements, none of which are commandments. And Yahusha was, in fact, the manifestation of the Torah. Those things are totally inconsistent with Christianity. In the same edict called the Law of God, which we have to recognize, God does not have a law. God does have a name, however, and it's the Torah of Yahweh, and it's comprised of teaching, that it is embodied in God's Ten Statements, which none of which are commandments. But each of those Ten Statements are extraordinarily destructive of the Christian religion. And the Messiah, Yahusha, was the living embodiment of the Torah. He was Torah observant. And so when Christians are opposed to the Torah, and there's not a single Christian that's Torah observant, because if they were Torah observant, they would cease to be a Christian, that the only way you can follow Yahusha is to be Torah observant. So to even mention this is lethal to Christianity. Now, they won't go on to say in a second paragraph under the law of God, salvation is all of grace and not of words. Wow. So God has a Torah, but you shouldn't pay any attention to it because salvation is not of words. Now, God begs to differ. According to him, forming a relationship with him and therefore being saved as a participant in the covenant is all about words. And here they say that even it's not of works, but is the futilage of obedience to the commandments. Well, if it's not of works, then how would it be something of obedience. Now, here's the reality. If you want to participate in a relationship, doesn't matter the relationship, you have to engage. If you're not willing to engage, there is no relationship that is meaningful. I don't care if it's boyfriend and girlfriend. I don't care if it's brother and sister. I don't care if it's father and son, mother and daughter. Do not care if it is a business relationship or if it's a musical relationship or it's an artistic relationship. Don't care. No matter the nature of a relationship, unless both parties engage, it is useless. In fact, it has it's negative. You know, if one party is making all of the contribution and the other party is simply the beneficiary and is contributing nothing, that relationship is actually debilitative on both parties. Both parties are lessened by a relationship when one party is contributing and the other party is a beneficiary. That's kind of like the entitlements of government. The person who receives that which they have not earned is destroyed morally. They're crippled, just as we're witnessing in Ukraine. And the one who gives is not only creates a dependency, which is no fun, but if you constantly give to someone who doesn't contribute to the relationship, you're just drained. Just as we're seeing also in Ukraine. And so this idea that we can have a covenant relationship with God without participation, without engaging, without doing something, destroys the entire notion of relationship. And as I said, it doesn't matter the type of relationship, but the covenant happens to be the most important relationship in the world. If you're not willing to engage and act upon it, and then engage with God and act with Him, then that relationship is of absolutely no value. And God doesn't save anyone apart from His covenant. So this notion that salvation is of grace and not of works is grotesquely misleading. Because salvation is only afforded to those who engage in the covenant, and engaging in the relationship is all about what we do. The choices we make of what we do, what we prioritize, what we focus on. And even in our salvation, God has asked us, invited us to these invitations, seven of them each year. And it's during our participation in those feasts that God saves us, saves His children. If you're not attending Passover as a child of the covenant, you are not going to become immortal. If you are not attending Yahweh's invitation and embracing His festival feast of Matzah, you are not vindicated. You are not perfected. You can't be saved. If you're not born into God's family on Bukkotim, firstborn children, as a result of observing those first two Mikra and embracing the terms and conditions of the covenant, you don't have a relationship with God. And thereby, you are not going to be invited to heaven. They get all of this wrong. And they talk about salvation, but it's futilage, is obedience to the commandments. Well, the first of those statements that God etched in stone says, "My name is Yahweh." I don't see them ever mentioning Yahweh's name. He says, "I am the only God." He even says, "There, if you attempt to exist with a God by a different name, it's over for you." Well, Jesus Christ would be about as different as you could be. There isn't any correlation between Jesus Christ and Yahweh. None. And also in that first statement, God says that He Himself is our Savior. In the second, God says, don't be religious. I'm not going to tolerate religion. And then in the whole context of saying, don't be religious. I don't want you bowing down to me. I don't want you praying in a religious setting. I don't want any trappings of religion. He says, you know, this is how fathers corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation. And then He says that there will only be thousands who receive His mercy, and they will receive it by closely examining and carefully considering the terms and conditions of this covenant. And the third says that if you negate the value of Yahweh's name, if you promote that which is untrue and therefore lifeless, that there will be no forgiveness. It is an edict directly, takes its site right at the core of Christianity, and blows the religion to smithereens. The moment you come to understand what God actually said, what he etched in stone, you can't be rational and remain a Christian. Now, point 20 of the Seventh-day Adventists is right to a point. They say the Creator established the Shabbat, that in 6 days of creation he rested on the seventh and instituted the Shabbat for all people as a memorial of creation. It's, again, partly true. The purpose of the Shabbat is not to memorialize creation. It's the pattern, but that pattern was on display in terms of 6 plus 1 to demonstrate to us there would be 6,000-year periods of human history after being expelled from the garden. Doesn't say the earth is 6,000 years old. God makes a point that's the opposite of that. He says from his perspective that he created the universe and the earth and life within 6 24-hour days, but 6 24-hour days from the perspective of the Creator at creation is next to 14 to 15 billion years from our perspective looking back, because time is relative. But as it relates to the Shabbat, God is telling us there's a plan here. You know, there's going to be 6 important periods of human history, all leading to his return, where he's going to establish the conditions of the Garden of Eden back here on earth. We lived with him in the Garden of Eden. We were booted out for corrupting his testimony. We're going to be led back in, those of us who've embraced the terms of conditions of the covenant, in year 6,000 Yah, which is now just 2019 years on our horizon. That's the message that is being conveyed. God wants us to know that 6, which is the number of man, who is a carbon-based life form with an atomic number of 6, plus God, who is 1, equals God's idea, 7, of perfection, of us being together. That's the message of the Shabbat. The message of the Shabbat is it's based upon both 7 and promise. It's God's promise to resolve all issues for us when we come together with him of 6 plus 1. That's God's idea of a perfect result. They don't have any of this here. They talk about the fourth commandment when it's actually the first of 7 instructions. The first 3 statements are simple statements. They're not instructions. They speak of this being the fourth commandment, which is absurd. God does not number them like this. Of God's unchangeable law. Well, if God's Torah were unchangeable, and it is, if it's eternal, which he says it is, which is, if it's enduring, which he affirms, then the basis of Christianity is torn asunder, because there would cannot be a New Testament, a new covenant. They then talk about the observance of the seventh day as a day of rest. Yes, it is to be observed. But if you observe it in the context of Yahweh's overall presentation of it, you'll learn what it actually represents. And it's not so much a day of rest as it is a day of reflection, of observation. They then go on to say of worship. God never once asked to be worshipped. In fact, he's opposed to it. The whole approach of our Heavenly Father to his covenant children is that he gets down on his knees to lift us up. So when we get down on our knees to lift him up, we're inverting everything that he has said and done. It is the ultimate disgrace. They speak of the Lord of the Sabbath being their Jesus. Not only is Jesus a bogus name, there was no one named Jesus. Not only is the name wrong, Lord, according to Yahweh, was Satan's title. Everything they have stated here, as it apart from the Shabbat is important, has been misleading. And that's their unique distinction. Even in their unique distinction, they get it wrong. Kind of reminds me of Jehovah's Witnesses. The one thing that they claim in their title is wrong. Yahweh's name isn't Jehovah. And so if you can't get the name right, what else do you have wrong if that's your main differentiation? If your main differentiation is Seventh-day Adventists and you don't understand the purpose of the Shabbat, what it means, the timeline that it provides for us, the method, the formula that God has described and provided for us to meet with Him, the fact that there are six steps to God, with the seventh being the destination, with Passover being the door that begins this journey over six specific days leading to the seventh, which is Sukkah, meaning to camp out with God, the destination. If you can't make that equation, if you can't connect those things together, then why are you even proclaiming it? Are you not missing everything that's important? When we return, we'll go to point 21, which is stewardship. This is an issue that Paul raised. Paul wanted to be paid. God doesn't. We'll return to stewardship when we return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. In the moments we have here in the second hour, we're going to do away with stewardship. This is what they write. They begin it by off there in a tangent, because lies are never believable unless there's a shred of truth associated with them. So there's never such thing as just a outright lie, because most lies aren't credible unless there's a shred of truth to them. This begins with a shred of truth. He says, it would be the children of the covenant, but they assume that they are the beneficiary of the promises, which that would be misleading. We are God's steward, entrusted by Him with the times and opportunities, abilities and possessions. Actually, we're not God's stewards. God has a corps of messengers. They're called Malak, and they are envoys, and they follow His directions, and they are God's stewards, His envoys, His ambassadors, His messengers, and they are spiritual beings. We are not His stewards. We are not entrusted by Him with time and opportunities. Time is not one of the gifts of God apart from the covenant. When we are members of the covenant family, one of the great benefits we're going to receive as members of the covenant family is time. We will become energy based, and on a photon of light, an energy based being, time is eternal. It all exists right now. It's very much like the Hebrew language itself. God does not entrust us with opportunities or abilities or possessions, which they claim here. But this is the myth of Christianity, of the micromanaging God that is responsible for giving someone everything. You know, when an athlete says, you know, I want to thank God for the ability that He has given me. That's not true. God did not give one person the ability to run fast, another person the ability to jump high. He didn't give somebody the ability to make a baseball move through the air so that it's hard to hit. Never gave anyone any one of those abilities. Never gave someone the ability to be successful in business. That's just not God's, not something He would be interested in, not something He would ever do. Never once does God say, I gave them these kind of abilities. Never. It is a complete myth of Christianity. It makes the person, though, think that they're dependent upon God for everything, and if something goes wrong in their life, it's because God chose it to go wrong. It's the Tim Tebow, I'm going to put my finger up and I want to thank God for that touchdown, as if God managed the game to cause His player to prevail and the other team to fail. It is absurd. God does not give us opportunities, does not give us abilities, does not give us possessions. God has given us one valuable gift beyond the three gifts that He's given to all of us, which are mortal life, free will, and a conscience so that we could make intelligence decisions. He has given us the gift of His Torah, which most people discard. He has given us within that Torah the opportunity to participate in His covenant, which most disregard. And for the covenant's children, He has provided seven steps which lead us out of this world and all of its failings to His home and camping out with Him. That's it. The rest of it is nothing but poppycock. This goes on to say, we are responsible to Him for their proper use. No, we're not. God never once says, you are responsible to me because I made you able to run fast. God never says, you know, I caused you to be wealthy, therefore you're responsible to me. Never. We acknowledge God's ownership by faithful service to him. Ownership is the thing of lords. That's why Christianity is so backwards in its understanding of who God is. Fathers, which is Father of the Covenant, Heavenly Father, is the antithesis of a lord. Fathers do not own their children. Fathers have no interest in ownership. Lords wish to own. And that's why the Christian Lord is so onerous. It's why the Christian Lord has laws that have to be obeyed. It's why the Christian Lord needs to be worshipped. You need to bow down to him just like you would earthly lords. It is a complete reversal of what God's actual nature is. Faithful service to him. God's not interested in faith. He's happy to have you work with him. If you want to work with him, welcome. But they end this by saying, and by returning tithes and giving offerings for the proclamation of his gospel and support of the growth of his church. That's Pauline. In Yah's testimony, there is no monetary tithe. In God's testimony, there is no church. In God's testimony, there is no gospel. In God's testimony, this whole thing is a pack of lies. And so here what you have is covetous men operating under religion that wants to steal those who are gullible's money.